Take that phone. Well, good afternoon. I think we should call the meeting to order. And I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Carl Magnus Larsson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Radiation Protection and Nuclear Safety Agency. And I'm going to be the chair for this session on environmental protection that we're going to have now. And beside me, I have got Dr. Brenda Howard. Brenda, you introduce yourself.
From the UK. I'm a radiologist with specialising in transfer to livestock and remediation, and recently in environmental protection. I was the coordinator of the PROTECT project and involved in the Erica tool development.
So, over to the programme, and we have three presentations during this session, and we actually have time until, I believe it is 4:15. So the way I propose that we run this is that we will have the three presentations going in one sequence, and we will then probably have plenty of time to take questions to all speakers after that. So there will be no questions directly after the presentation, and most likely the next presentation is anyway going to answer the questions. So whatever leftovers we will have in the end, we will deal with in the end. So that's the way we are going to run this. So without any further ado, I would like to introduce the first speaker, who is Jan Pentreath, who is an emeritus professor at the University of Reading. And he has been a member of the main commission of the ICRP since 2003, and he is the chair of the ICRP Committee 5, which is on the protection of the environment. So Jan is going to speak to us on principles and concepts in radiation protection of the environment. Jan, over to you.
Thank you, Chairman. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad I wore a tie. I didn't realise I got to have my photograph taken. I don't usually wear a tie. What I'd like to do over the next 20 minutes or so is just take you very briefly through what has been happening in ICRP over the last few years. And I want to start, if I can, and push a button and something happens with that. The more observant amongst you, I'm sure, will have noticed that a big difference between ICRP 60 and ICRP 103 is that that document contained this statement, which is quite different from their approach in the past. The ICRP actually introduced their own environmental protection objective, and it reads as follows. You can read it same as I can. Prevent or reduce the frequency of deleterious radiation effects to a level where they would have a negligible impact on the maintenance of biological diversity, conservation of species, or the health and status of natural habitats, communities, and ecosystems. Things that are easily said. Things that have been said before in various UN documents, and indeed work that the IAEA had done before. It's a sort of general statement that is very difficult to disagree with. And bearing in mind the different attitudes to protection of the environment around the world, it's a reasonable level of commonality. The trouble with that sort of statement, however, is how then do you translate it into something that is useful and practical? And that really was the challenge for ICRP and for Committee 5. The basic questions you might ask yourself, whether you were involved in the subject or not, are essentially these. If you've got radionuclides in the environment, what would the doses to the biota be? It's a reasonable question, but it begs questions as to how you actually calculate them. What are will be the effects of radiation or the risk of effects for the biota as a result of these doses? Again, question that's easily stated, but where's the data in relation to this? Bearing in mind this subject has been rattling around for about 40 years, but never in any sort of structured way. It's just a lot of miscellaneous information. And given that, what would the consequences be? What would it matter in an environmental context? And even if you knew all of this, what could you or would you want to do about it? Again, very interesting questions. Essentially, if you break it down in a sort of scientific way, What you really need to look at are these particular relationships. What's the relationship between exposure and dose, dose and effect, and the effects and consequences for different types of animals and plants? Well, given the total range of animals and plants that are out there, again, it's an enormous open-ended question. And you could go on trying to answer these questions for years. And you can use this in two ways. You can either use it as a reason for not doing anything because the subject is just too complex and the questions are too difficult to answer, so you essentially don't do anything. Or you actually jump in and try to do something. And that's what we did. And bearing in mind that the way that protection of human beings has evolved, one of the great benefits of it was developing points of reference, developing nominal values, actually creating some islands of knowledge that you could then interpolate between or extrapolate from. And that's, right or wrong, the approach that we took. So we started off just trying to take some reference animals and plants. And why this set? Well, there's no perfect set, but if you just cast your eyes over this set, one thing that should immediately occur to you is that you can keep them all in captivity. You can do experiments on them. If you're going to have points of numerical reference, there's no point having animals and plants that you can never gain any data from. And indeed, many of these plants and animals have already been used in toxicity experiments and so on in relation to other chemicals. But they're also, in a way, the sort of thing that you might expect to find. If you're looking in the marine environment, you might expect to find seaweed on the shore, crabs under rocks, flatfish in the nearby estuary, and so on. And you could say that for all of these. But if you just look at those 12, they're complex enough, because you have to look at the egg, the larvae, the adult. If you look at a frog, it's got an egg, and then it's got a tadpole, then the frog comes out on land, lives in different environments, different exposures, different dose rates, different dose effects. So you just take one of those, it's complex enough. The human being is a pretty simple animal, really, compared with some of these. So that already gives you enough problems. If we had various criteria for trying to select them, and they're sort of more or less along this line, and the purpose of the animals and plants. First of all, to get a sound scientific basis. And I think a sound scientific basis is important because the first people you would have a dialogue in relation to this subject are other scientists, not the public. The public, by and large, can't tell the difference between a becquerel and a cockerel, and you simply have to accept that, and that's it. But in the world of environmental protection, there are good scientists. They may not know much about radiation, but they're good environmental scientists. And you sit down and have a dialogue with them. They want to know, because virtually every industry has to take steps in relation to protection of the environment. The one exception has been the nuclear industry. Largely, I think, because very little has happened in the nuclear industry over the last two or three decades, so you have to welcome it into the 21st century, because other industries have had to go through this exercise. So you want a good, sound scientific basis that you can have a dialogue with other scientists. Secondly, the points of reference. Why these points of reference? Well, for the biologists amongst you, you will realize that if you're trying to look for some sort of commonality within different types of animals, the highest level that you can go is the level of family. You've got species, you've got genus, you've got family, and all the way then up to phyla. Above family, it's a scientific argument as to how you group animals and plants. But there is an international agreement at the level of family that these types of animals and plants have some sort of internal biological consistency, therefore make a useful point of reference. They all have nice Latin names, and the names we use, like duck and so on, is the English equivalent of those Latin names. We've chosen these 12 as conceptual and numeric models. In other words, if you can understand something about the bits that I've just said, exposure to dose and effect and so on, in relation to these types of animals and plants at different stages in their life cycle, then you may be able to extrapolate and interpolate to other types of animals and plants. We use them to look into aspects of dosimetry, to look at radiation effects and so on. But they are not what we are necessarily trying to protect. Most of our information in relation to protection of human beings is around a hermaphrodite voxel phantom. We're not trying to protect hermaphrodite voxel phantoms. you don't see a lot of them wandering around outside Heathrow Airport anyway. But so, you know, that, do get that in mind. These are points of reference, not necessarily what we're trying to protect. However, you may be, because they're very common types of animals and plants. One of the things that was difficult to do was to gather together the information in relation to radiation effects, because experiments have been done for all sorts of purposes in all sorts of ways, good and bad, there's symmetry to go with it over many years, and the literature is sort of generally scattered. Most of the information relates to experiments where they only quote the dose rate. They're not quite sure what the integrated dose is, but calculate the dose rate. What we did was to look at the information that was available, either precisely on these types or something very close, and arrange it in sort of bands of orders of magnitude like this. And then looking at those bands of orders of magnitude of dose, we selected areas where we thought, well, if you're getting that sort of dose rate, you need to stop and think and ask yourself lots of other interesting questions. And indeed, what you would like to do is to avoid getting into that zone in the first place. And those shaded areas we called DCRLs, rather complicated title, and we probably thought of something different. But essentially, it's a band of dose rate within which we think for those 12 types of animals and plants, there's some chance of deleterious effects due to ionizing radiation occurring to individuals. Radiation affects individuals. You may be trying to protect populations, but it's the individual that's affected. It's then a question of how many individuals within a population are affected, but this is the starting point. So we selected these bands. Now, why bands? Why not simply a number? Well, if you look at what we do for human radiation protection, we use bands. If you look at these three bands, they're actually in 103, but not in this form. They're in a table. But essentially, we use three different bands of dose rate that we use in relation to exposure under different situations. Constraints for the public exposure, constraints set for occupational exposure, and reference levels that we use in relation to an emergency and so on. They're in bands. So setting out the information that we derived looking at the literature, setting them out in bands is quite consistent, and hopefully it's the sort of thing that would be recognisable and interpretable by those looking at the environment from the same point of view. And if you look at them, they pan out something like that. Now then, if you then want to use this information in a structured way, again, look at what we do in relation to protection of human beings in an environmental context. And again, you won't find this in 103, but we put it in our own publications. You start off with the basic information on reference male and reference female, then you have the reference person. From that information, you then come up with those dose limits, constraints, and so on. You then apply that to different exposure situations, the planned, emergency, and the existing, and you need the data sets to go with it. What you're trying to protect, however, is the representative person. As I said, you're not trying to protect the reference person. You're not trying to protect the Vauxhall Phantom. It's real people somewhere. But you're going to protect them via the use of nominal values and reference values. So just to remind you, in relation to the exposure situations, again, this I find people get a bit confused over this in relation to 103. It's, when we talk about planned exposure situations, it's the situation that is planned, not the exposure. You don't plan to expose people, it's a situation. You've got planned exposure situations, you've got existing exposure situations, you've got emergency situations, not emergency exposures, emergency situations. So if you look at what we've done in relation to using reference animals and plants, then the sort of basic arrangement is like this. Start off with our information on reference animals and plants. From that, we derive these DCRLs. And think of that as within the box. What you're then going to apply it to is outside the box. And of course, there are bits missing from that. And what we've done recently is given quite a bit of considerable thought in relation to how you would then apply it to different exposure situations. The documents in relation to this will be coming out for public consultation in the very near future, quite a large document that breaks these things down. What I get to go through now is sort of a very quick summary in relation to that. Also notice on the bottom, the most recent publication that came out is in relation to concentration ratio data for all of this. So essentially, I think if we But the next stage, which, as I said, we hope to get out very, very soon, we will have completed more or less the sort of overall framework. You will notice in that previous one, we talk about the representative organism. Not the reference one, that's the reference you use. What are you going to apply it to? What you're going to apply it to is what you actually want to protect. And what you actually want to protect could vary tremendously. You could be, and David, hopefully you'll ask, have lots of questions, and hopefully David Copplestone here, who's going to talk afterwards, will be able to answer some of these. What are you actually going to try to protect? You could be trying to protect the environment in general. That may be your legislation. Thou shalt not pollute the environment. Therefore, you have to demonstrate when you're operating, licensing or whatever, a nuclear facility, whatever end of the nuclear fuel cycle, that you fulfill that bit of legislation. You may want to be wanting to protect a specific habitat that is close to a nuclear facility that has its special requirements for protection. You may need to protect specific types of biota. Birds are greatly protected all around the world. Particularly, interestingly enough, ducks, wildfowl, they're international protection areas because they migrate and they land in estuaries, feed and move on. There's international protection from them. And these are quite often where nuclear facilities and loads of other industrial facilities are built. Most industrial facilities have to demonstrate in their discharges that they will not discharge anything through environmental quality standards, chemicals and so on, that will not adversely affect the fauna, flora of the estuaries, including the ducks that go through it. But not the nuclear industry, just a black one. Or, as I said, you may want to protect particular species. Very little has happened, as I said, in the nuclear industry, I think, over the last 20 or 30 years, but in the meantime, environmental legislation has moved on very rapidly, and it has affected other industries. So, looking at a nuclear renaissance, hopefully, which we desperately need, the sort of questions that might arise would be these. If you're going to build a new nuclear facility or relicense existing ones and so on, questions could be varied. You know, what's the potential impact on natural resources, fisheries? Estuaries, as I said, which are a favoured spot for nuclear facilities, are big breeding grounds for fisheries. So the fishermen are going to be asking questions. Potential impact on the local habitat in general. Wetlands are protected all over the globe these days. Specific groups of biota and so on. Or simply allaying general public concerns. The public want to know, well, okay, you've got to build that. What if it has a leak? What if it goes bang? What if this? What if that? How do you answer the question? You have the knowledge to answer the question. Can you deal with it? Or do you just shrug your shoulders and say, well, you know, we didn't think it would happen, but it has. There we are. It's not very comforting to the public. They ask, nowadays, reasonable questions. What it is you're actually trying to protect in relation to what we have in terms of the reference animals and plants, the differences could be considerable. Their biology is different. The exposure pathways could be different. Dosimetry could be different, the effects are different, the consequences could be different. Which sounds rather complicated, but actually, given the 12 that we've got, that set, and the types of lifestyles that they have, the biology could be different. It's not going to be that different, and it's quantifiable to some extent. The exposure pathway, well, they're either going to be exposed through something falling out of the atmosphere, what they're going to eat, or their immersion in water. So exposure pathways aren't going to be greatly different. Dosimetry. Well, you can extrapolate and interpolate quite well in terms of dosimetry over different sizes in relation to different energies and so on. Effects. Well, given the level of knowledge that we have about radiation effects on different types of animals and plants, again, I don't think much of that is going to be different by more than, say, a factor of 5 or so, an order of magnitude at the most. The consequences, of course, are what you need to evaluate. So, how would you apply these to different exposure situations? Well, let's say you're going to build a new nuclear facility somewhere, which what we would call a planned normal situation for an individual site. First of all, you would probably, these days, have to comply with quite a range and a basket of national and international environmental legislation. Here in the UK, you've got national legislation, but a whole raft of European legislation that covers the environment in all sorts of ways. And you would have to satisfy that legislation before you can get a license to operate. And now, of course, you'd have to comply with these broad ICRP objectives if you want to say that you follow what the ICRP advises. Hopefully, if you do the first, it would satisfy the second. So we're not trying to make it more complicated. So if you take one of these DCRL bands for one or more of the relevant reference animals and plants as your starting point, as your point of reference, then what you would aim to do is not to get into that band, because by definition, once you get into that band, you start asking all sorts of complicated questions. And bearing in mind that would apply to, say, the whole population of something in an area, an ecosystem or an estuary, then for a single source, you would actually want to stop short of that. I don't think that would pose any problem whatsoever to any operation. And when you think that this sort of requirement is required of a sewage treatment plant, a sewage treatment plant dealing with human waste has to satisfy certain environmental quality standards in relation to a discharging environment. So if a sewage treatment plant could do it, I'm quite sure that a nuclear facility would be able to do this. And if it couldn't, there's something seriously wrong, I think. The factors that one would consider in relation to this would be, as I said, what it is you're actually trying to protect. And that may vary. It might be quite complex nowadays because there are so many almost conflicting pieces of legislation. But you would also ask yourself the question of, well, what sort of area are we talking about? Are we talking about a square kilometre off the end of the pipeline? Are we talking about the Irish Sea? Or what are we talking about? You need to get that into some sort of perspective. What sort of fraction of the population are we talking about? Okay, you might calculate. Some individuals get quite a high dose rate, but if it's only 0.01% of the population, it's not really going to make much difference. You might want to consider other discharges, abstractions into the area, what other stress effects are having and so on. You'd certainly want to dialogue with stakeholders. Who are the people who are going to be complaining most? Is it the fishermen, the wildlife people, or whatever? And the degree of precaution you may think that's necessary. For example, we don't at the moment have any allowance in relation to radiation rating factors, so it depends on the new plants that you're going on. What about existing situations? There are quite a lot of contaminated sites around, and every now and then we create more, as you all know. And the question then arises, well, is there anything we could do about it? Should we do anything about it? The answer may well be no. And quite often, if you try to do something about it, you actually make the situation even worse than it was in the first place, which is something you need to bear in mind. But nevertheless, the question reasonably arises. Okay, you're going to build this nuclear facility, it goes bang, you do something, you've got a contaminated area. Is there anything you can do about it? Well, again, you can either shrug your shoulders or say, well, we have looked at it in some sort of structured way. And what would you do in relation to looking at it in a structured way? Well, you would look at the potential for reducing the dose rates to whatever the fauna and flora were in the area. And of course, this would be an iterative process. And we would suggest that at least what you would try to do for the purposes of the exercise is not to try to get to the bottom of this DCRL band. In other words, not to go back to the situation you had before the area is contaminated, but at least try to get down into that sort of band. You've got an order of magnitude then to play with, but you would sort of aim at that. And that would give you some purpose in what you were trying to do. Well, what about emergency exposure situations? Is there anything you can seriously, usefully do in relation to an emergency? The thing has gone bang. You can do something about people, but can you do something about the environment? Well, the question arises in two different ways, really. If you've got choices as to where you can actually site a reactor or another nuclear facility, the questions that may arise in relation to the planning is, well, what would be the impact on the environment in general if you put it here? Equally, of course, there's always going to be somebody who says, well, around this area, we particularly want to protect that. So if you've got a choice where it could be in a river, on an estuary, or on the coast, then it may be the question is, what if there's an accident? How would it affect this very specific area? So the questions can arise, and again, you need to be in a position, I think, to answer it sensibly. Well, what if the accident happens? I had an accident, as you know, quite recently in Fukushima. And if you read the press in relation to, say, the radionuclide concentrations in the sea as a result of enormous quantities being deposited into it, then the statements were, well, the levels are 10,000 times higher than normal or something, which is not particularly instructive or useful. In fact, it's quite frightening. There's not a lot more you can say, really. Most of the questions are asked about what about protection of the environment? Well, they say, well, you know, we stop people eating things. But that's not the question. The question is, what about the environment itself? And again, this is common in all industries. You look at the oil industry, the rig that went bang in the Gulf. People were killed. They're still asking questions about the impact on the environment. It's a question that goes on and on. And will go on. It happens in every large industrial accident. We don't have them very often in the nuclear industry, but they don't. And there will be another one, and it'll be different. You can also imagine, of course, that in terms of an emergency situation, the exposure of human beings could be absolutely minimal. You could have a huge release, say, into the sea. How do you protect people? Well, you keep them away from the area and stop seafood. Easy. Well, what about the impact on the environment, people say? What's it doing out there? I'm a fisherman. Is it killing my environment? Whatever. Or simply people who are interested in the environment. What would you do then? Well, you'd need to express it in some sort of numerical way. And there was no good using these DCRLs. What other industries do is they have acute effects levels. And it's a really acute effect you would take. So you would look at these bands of radiation effect and go further up and sort of select other levels. As I said, something like an acute effect level. So that if you had an accident and you were then going to report against it, you would probably get a set of data like that. And that would enable you to communicate with the public and everybody else as to what you thought the impact on the environment was as time went on in respect to that incident. And we don't have much data in relation to Fukushima, but I've tried to dig out one or two numbers and sort of calculate dose rates to form. 30th of March, 150 metres away, those symbols there are sort of dose rates that I've calculated. I wouldn't publish them, but they're sort of simply looking at it. And in relation to the terrestrial environment, you're talking about dose rates which are way above those DCRL bands and up in the area where they will be having an effect on individual plants and animals around that site. The consequences are, I don't know, but they're up in that area. So, putting all this together, if you like, what we've been trying to do in the ICRP is to introduce more clarity into it, I think. If you're making statements about protecting the environment, you can't just pull this out of the air. And as I said at the beginning, if you're going to have a sensible dialogue with the scientific community, you need to say, we've drawn these conclusions through an auditable trail, if you like, of scientific information and our interpretation. Respect to the scientific basis relating to things that I've mentioned, exposure to dose and so on, and what we're trying to achieve in relation to different exposure situations. We've had a quick trot around the course. I mean, the question was a very interesting one. What can you say about protecting the environment? And we've tried to sort of draw this information together. There's still sort of issues you might arise. How would you comply with any of this? Well, probably through, you wouldn't want to calculate doses, probably by looking at concentrations of radionuclides, which would serve the same purpose, essentially, for protecting human beings. The dosimetry that we've come up with is pretty crude, and we could really do with something better for organisms once they get over a kilogram, and we are doing something about that. And, as I said, all the information is simply in terms of grey, and we know that there are different radiation rating factors to take into account, and Cathy will tell you something about that later on. So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John. We go to the next speaker, which is going to be Dr. David Copplestone, who is a senior teacher in environmental radioactivity at the University of Stirling and has been involved in the development of approaches to radiological protection of the environment for the last 10 years. And he is also a member of ICRP Committee 5. And David's going to talk about the application of radiological protection measures to meet different environmental protection criteria. So, David, please.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And good afternoon, everybody. Jan has just probably stolen a number of my slides, so I apologize for some duplication in advance. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take us back a little bit. I'm going to look at some of the legislation in terms of environmental protection in its broadest sense and try and build the picture up a little bit and provide a little bit more background to what Jan has just discussed before looking a little bit more in detail at the some examples from experience that we've had, particularly here in the UK, and then some information just to reiterate what Jan's just said. So if you take a look at the kind of information and the kind of sources of information that we have on environmental protection, it kind of breaks down in terms of international summits and protocols, in terms of the approaches that international organizations are taking. And often those types of legislation, and I'll come to the kind of words that are used in a minute, the kinds of things that we're being talked about at these international levels will sometimes cascade down, or usually cascade down, into national legislation and regulations. And that's really where we will then be looking at it as individual countries and trying to actually make some sense of it to be able to demonstrate that the environment is protected. And to me, the key word in all of this is to be able to demonstrate. Jan talked about the clarity in terms of the approaches and so on, and being able to put it on a uniform footing with chemicals, etc. And really what we're trying to be able to do is to demonstrate that the nuclear industry and the use of radioactive substances in medical facilities, in research facilities and so on, that the releases that come out from those facilities do not have any impact on the environment. And the question then as to where we start with this is, well, what do we actually mean by environmental protection? And if we just take some examples, there is actually a paper on this, but it was actually produced for the first international ICRP International Symposium last October, and is being published through the ICRP mechanisms. But in there, we look at a bit more detail in terms of some of the other international conventions and summits that are available, and also some of the national legislation, which I'll come to in a minute. But I've just selected a few just to give you some examples. And one of the pieces of legislation is the Ramsar Convention. It's not particularly new legislation either, 1971, in terms of the approach. There are something like 160 countries signed up to this. And the Ramsar Convention actually has protected, or protects, about 191 million hectares of land across the globe. It's there to protect wetlands. So as Jan mentioned, you know, we have the ducks in the ICRP approach, in the RAPs. They're there to represent the wildfowl and so on that utilize these sites. We've also got the Rio Convention, which has established the framework for environmental protection. And in particular, its principle 19 actually looks at environmental impact assessment, something that we need to do in terms of many of the new facilities and the new processes that we actually want to take on board in our individual countries. But it's not all about environmental protection in a way as well. If you look at things like Kyoto, it's actually providing the opportunity for the nuclear industry in terms of actually addressing the fact that we need to reduce our carbon emissions. But in those circumstances, we have to also be able to demonstrate, coming back to that word again, we have to be able to demonstrate that the environmental impacts from the nuclear industry in the power production are not actually going to impact in environmental impacts in the same way. But the problem with these pieces of legislation, as you'll see in a minute, there is no specific target set in terms of the numeric criteria or anything like that, or even the types of pollutants that are mentioned. If you come to the national level, in the national level, I've just picked out here from four different countries. I'm not going to go through all this in detail, but just pick out certain words. So protect and manage flora and fauna. Resource management. Sustainable development is what we're talking about here. How have we enshrined the environmental protection in various different ways? Improving the environment is also another issue. So how do we actually demonstrate that we're actually improving the environmental quality? How do we integrate the social and economic aspects into this process? Well, that fits very nicely with the process of optimization and so on in terms of the as low as reasonably achievable that we use in human radiological protection already. So applying the same sorts of principles to environmental protection for the purposes here should actually help to address that integration of the system. So it's quite important that we actually understand what we're talking about here. And what these often lead to are something which you might term a protection goal. And by a protection goal, we start to actually break down what we're trying to achieve at the local or national level. So what I've got here is some information about what you might term the protection goals. They're often qualitative statements. We want to protect the environment. We want to actually ensure the quality of the environment. And I'll give you a couple of examples in a minute. They don't actually give you any numeric criteria quite often. They don't say, we don't want a population change of more than 5% in a bird species. We have to interpret that as the scientists who are actually trying to demonstrate whether the environment is protected or not. But what they do is they set out the framework which we're trying to use. So just to take you through a couple of examples, this is an example from Sweden. It's just looking at the different types of environmental policy goals that Sweden has. And the key thing here is that the overall goal for Swedish environmental protection is that they're going to pass on the environment in a manner which is not going to cause major environmental problems for future generations. How do we demonstrate that from a nuclear power point or use of radioactive substances perspective? How can we actually address that particular kind of environmental protection goal? Here's perhaps a bit more closely aligned one. This is an example from the US, which is talking about water quality. And here, in this particular one, this is from a particular harbour, and what this group, the stakeholder group, has agreed is that the water quality and the fish, if you like, the quality of the fish for consumption is not actually going to be impacted. And my question to you again then is, well, how do we demonstrate that if radioactive substances are involved? And this is where we start to have to think about the different types of systems that we have in place to actually address this. The problems are that the objectives are often aspirational in nature. They're not something that we can actually definitively go out put our finger on. This is exactly the amount of change that we expect or don't want. They also do not mention, in most cases, whether it's radioactive substances, whether it's heavy metals, whether it's organic contaminants and so on. We are left to our own devices in interpreting this information. And that does lead to some differences in different countries. Certainly here in the UK, I'll give you an example for the UK in a minute, but certainly in the UK, the interpretation of the Habitats and the Wild Birds Directives was that this should include radioactive substances. That's not necessarily been the case in all European countries. And we have this problem that these environmental impacts are given at the broadest sense. So we need to somehow define criteria that we're going to actually use for the assessment. It's now worth noting as well, and I'll come to ICRP on the next slide, but it's and Jan's just had those on the screen anyway. It's now worth noting that the requirements, if you like, for environmental protection from radioactive substances is now enshrined in the International Basic Safety Standards and in the International Safety Fundamentals. And it includes protection of the people and the environment. And you can read on the screen here the types of wording that's in the basic safety standards and that's actually requiring assessment. But again, it doesn't give us specific criteria which we can use to actually make the assessments and actually demonstrate whether we're achieving this or not. So it's talking about prevention of these radiological effects on both human health but also on flora and fauna. One of the things that's enshrined within the international legislation now as well is this idea of the fact that it's about sustainability and the use of the resources. I mean, if you think about it logically, if you have a fishery, then actually in many cases the biggest impact on that fishery is our consumption processes. So it's actually going out and fishing. We are actually deliberately going out to catch those fish for consumption purposes. But what we have to ensure is that when those fish populations are stressed, as they are from our activities for fishing in many cases, then what we have to actually make sure is that we are actually not putting more stress onto that population, which is actually going to cause us future problems as well. You also have the ICRP protection objectives from publication 103, but also reiterated in 108 as well. And Jan's just been through these. But again, how do we actually turn these into criteria that we can actually use? So we have, remember this as well, we have all of these international conventions and these legislations and agreements and so on, but many of the indicators that we have in terms of environmental quality are actually still going in the wrong direction. We are still seeing species go extinct. We are still seeing increases in releases of greenhouse gases. We are still seeing impacts in the environment at both a local and a global level. And that's despite all of these approaches. And if we want to do something about that, then we need to actually be able to demonstrate what we're actually trying to protect, that we're actually protecting the environment from the activities of the use of radioactive substances. So coming home closer to Glasgow and to the UK, I mentioned earlier about the various EU directives that apply to the UK. And the ones I want to focus on particularly are the Habitats and Wild Birds Directives, which set out the approach for across Europe and have been implemented in the UK through the Conservation of Habitats and Species Regulations. You can see some of the types of animals that we have to try and protect, so things like otters, snails, birds of different sorts, this is an oyster catcher, Atlantic salmon and so on, in different ecosystems and different habitats. We have situations under the Habitats Directive where something like 200 different types of habitats require protection. In those circumstances, we often are just told it's a mudflat or it's a sand dune system or a particular type of woodland or a particular type of grassland. We don't actually have the species that we're actually trying to protect. So the first job that we have is actually to identify which are the key species that are present in each of those ecosystems that we then need to protect. And specified in the legislation in general, in the conservation legislation in the UK, is something like 1,000 species that are listed that need to be protected in its own right. So we have to be able to break this down, and as Jan said, you know, we have to be able to use points of reference to actually address this. Something else just to point out, I'm not sure if you can see that very well, it's not very visible on my screen here anyway, so I apologise for that, but what I wanted to show you here was across the UK, the protected areas that are involved. It's probably best seen in this graph here and this figure here with the darker green. And you can see that there are protected areas across the whole of the UK. But what's actually interesting, and this is in part because the legislation for the conservation has come in at a later stage than when our nuclear facilities were built, but actually if you take and map our nuclear facilities within the UK, they actually arise or they actually are present within many of those areas that are actually under the protection of these particular directives or the regulations in the UK. So by default, and nothing to do with the fact that these sites were there because of the nuclear power plants and so on, but by default, we have radioactive substances being discharged directly into these sites where we are actually being asked to demonstrate, actively demonstrate, that there is no adverse impact on those sites. And the UK Environment Agencies, so this is the Environment Agency in England and Wales and CEPA up in Scotland, have a duty to comply with these EU Birds and Habitats Directives. And that requires the review of all authorizations that can actually release, in this case, radioactive substances, but actually all forms of pollutants into the environment. So this is not unique to radiation. It's actually part of a much wider process. In addition to that, there has to be an ongoing process for any new permits that are requested or any variations to the existing permits have to also be assessed as well. And in those circumstances, this is an ongoing rolling program that's trying to be in place with the aim of ensuring that no authorised activity or release of any form of chemicals or radioactive substances can have an impact, and this is another one, directly or indirectly, and that means it's about affecting prey species and predator species and so on within the integrity of these so-called Natura 2000 sites, which are the special sites of conservation interest. The point I want to make here, I'm trying to make here, is that this is about conservation specifically. So this isn't about radiation protection. I'm sure most of you sitting in this room probably believe that there are no problems out in the environment from the releases of controlled, well-regulated use of radioactive substances. And I would agree with you. I look out the window at most facilities and I would suggest that there are no major impacts from radioactive substances. But the difficulty is that we have to be able to demonstrate that that is the case. And that's always very difficult. So this is what this is all about. sorry, I should have clicked on a slide. So as Jan's described, we have to come up with different ways of doing this. And the ICRP approach has really looked at different approaches to do this. Jan has outlined the approach that's been adopted within ICRP. Really, all I want to do now for a minute or two is just to consider where we actually place this protection system. We talked, for those of you in the session yesterday on protection of the environment, there was much discussion about whether the focus should be on individuals or actually on populations and ecosystems was where the focus should really be. But there was lots of discussion about whether using the cellular mechanism at markers and so on could actually be used to actually demonstrate protection of the population and so on, and the interlinking through the population modelling that was being undertaken. So really we have to start looking at where we focus our efforts here. But remember that much of the information that we have is actually focused on the individual. A lot of the effects information that we have has not been about looking at effects on populations. It's been about experiments on small numbers of animals and so on in a laboratory. And we're currently trying to adapt the information that we have on biological effects of radiation exposure from a variety of different sources and uses in the laboratory, for example, and field studies that weren't designed to actually give us numeric criteria in the first instance. If you have a look at the ecotox literature, you'll find that there are standard tests that are available for different forms of chemicals. So when a new chemical comes on the market, it will go through a fairly rigorous process of testing on test species of known types and so on. There is a set procedure, if you like, to actually help you to define the numeric criteria. We don't have that within radiation because we've never set out to understand the effects of radiation in that way. So we're trying to adapt the information that we have on biological effects to actually give us the information that we need for developing numeric approaches, criteria, sorry. Another way of looking at this is to try and look at the top down and say, well, is the ecosystem actually impacted? And actually look at the ecosystem itself and try to understand whether that's been impacted. But one of the problems there is that you cannot quite often, if you see effects in the environment, you won't necessarily be able to link it directly to the causative agent. So if you want, as a regulator, for example, to be able to take steps to actually deal with a situation which you know is causing an effect in the environment, you need to know what the causative agent is so you can actually go and address the cause of the problem. And quite often when you're looking at ecosystem approaches and so on, by the time you see effects in the ecosystem, it may even be too late to actually go out and correct the situation that you're trying to deal with. So there is this problem between, and this tension between, the fact that we're interested in populations, and we're interested in the ecosystems and the individuals. It's all right, because I can skip loads of slides in a minute, because Jan's done them all. So the way that you can do this is you can actually go out and you can make biological monitoring measurements and so on. You can look at different parameters in the environment. You can do studies on the population density. You can look at age distributions in the populations. I'll just say, and I should have mentioned this when I talked about the demonstrate point, we have to demonstrate that the protection of the environment is in place, but that has to be commensurate with the risk that's associated with the use of radioactive substances. And as I mentioned, in many cases, the risk is going to be low. Risk of impact is going to be low. To go out and do these kind of biological surveys and so on, however, is a very intense amount of work is required, and is perhaps not consistent with what we're trying to do. Another way to do this is to go out and make measurements where you actually monitor the activity concentrations in biota and so on. But bear in mind that certainly in the UK, from the perspective that we're talking about, they're protected species. So we can't go out and cull these species. So how do we do this? how do we actually go out and make these monitoring and make the use of this information? The various attempts have been made. This is a summary table that came from the PROTECT project of all of the different numeric criteria that have been produced to actually look at the different effects levels. So some of this has been going back to the early 90s to UNSCEAR and IEA work and the National Council for Radiological Protection in the US. There have been recent European projects like ERICA and PROTECT, which have also looked at different numeric criteria and different approaches to generating these criteria. But what I wanted to point out here is that you also have to be aware of the caveats that go in behind this table, because in many cases, there are wording associated with these particular numbers. So for example, well, IEA and, in particular, they were never recommended values for use in these kind of assessments. They were guidelines at best in terms of what you might see in terms of the effects in the different populations. Many of these say that these are dose rates to maximally exposed individuals, not populations and so on. So we need to just be aware of the caveats that go into these in terms of understanding how we actually apply these numeric criteria. What is interesting is that you do start to see some consistency in the numbers. ERICA used an approach to derive, a quantitative mathematical approach to derive its value. And it's for all ecosystems and all wildlife species. So it doesn't actually segregate the radio sensitivity, if you like, of the different species. And that's one of the advantages if we talk about the ICRP approach. So I'm just going to skip these because Jan's actually talked about these already. I know, so I said I can skip a load of these. Come on, why is it not moving? Oh, just want to go back to this one for a second. The thing, what's interesting about this approach with the DCRLs is that actually it starts to give you information about the radio sensitivity of the different species that are present in the environment. And that's something that we need to take into account, again, if we want to be commensurate with the risk when we're doing the risk assessments that we're being asked to do to demonstrate whether the environment is protected from the releases of radioactive substances. I'm going to skip those and just come to the conclusions. The point I really wanted to make then here is that, you know, I know that some people think that in the industry that there's a threat of overregulation here within the radiation protection of the environment aspects. But what I would suggest here is that if it is done appropriately and commensurate with the risks, so i.e. we don't believe that there is a major risk in the environment from the use of radioactive substances, then we can actually address and help the continued use of these radioactive substances, whilst I'm putting this on the same footing as the if you like, the Congress theme, whilst being able to clearly demonstrate in a clear and transparent manner how we've actually demonstrated that the environment is protected. And I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, David. We proceed to the next speaker. It's Dr. Catherine Higley, professor and head of the Department of Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics at Oregon State University. And she has been working in the field of environmental health physics and radioecology for more than 30 years. And she's a member, as well, of the ICRP Committee 5 and a certified health physicist, and is going to talk about RB and radiation weight and factors as applied in the context of protection of the environment from ionizing radiation. Catherine.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to take a slightly different turn. Jan got up and talked about the general context for environmental protection. David was giving some background in terms of laws and regulations and how this might be applied. And they kept mentioning this little bit about the dose calculations. And I'm going to look in depth a little bit more about the issue of RBE or radiation weighting factors. And in the arena of human radiation protection, we understand pretty fundamentally that different radiation types vary in their biological impact and for the same absorbed dose. I mean, this is something we've recognized for a very, very long time, nearly 100 years. And the question becomes then, if you have organisms that are exposed to alpha particles, for example, or very low energy beta emitters or photons, can we use this insight in developing some sort of radiation-modifying factor for use in plants and animals? And the answer, sort of looking at the literature, is yes, yes, and no. And so what I'd like to do today is give you a very brief presentation on the work that's it's coming to conclusion, the task group for ICRP Committee 5. My colleagues are Dave Coker from Senes Oak Ridge, Doug Chambers from Senes Canada, and Almedina Rial from Thiamat. Sorry. So what I'm going to talk about today is a little bit about RBE measurements and calculations. I'm a professor, a teacher, and so I'm going to drag you kicking and screaming through some of the radiation fundamentals that you're probably very much aware of, but I think it's important to sort of remind everyone about where we are and where we're going. I'm going to talk a little bit about stochastic and deterministic effects, summarize what we have seen in the data, and then talk just a little bit about the challenges that we have in going forward. So just as a point of reference, you know, an RBE, relative biological effectiveness, is a ratio that you develop based on laboratory studies. And it's defined as the ratio of an absorbed dose D in a tissue to a dose from your reference radiation that causes quantitatively and qualitatively an equal effect. And so this RBE value is derived from a set of observations for tissue cultures or responses of tissues in animals, in humans, and it refers to a defined endpoint, and it's made under a very specified set of exposure conditions. And what we have done in human radiation protection is we've taken a look at this data set, and we have developed sort of nominal values that are appropriate in terms of protecting humans under very specific circumstances. When we're developing or creating these RBEs, we have to come up with a reference radiation. And there's not a single value. There have been multiple values that have been used, multiple reference radiations that have been used, including cesium-137, cobalt-60. We have X-rays, 250 kbp, for example. But what you find is if you compare the reference radiations to each other, you actually have a variation in your RBE on the order of a factor of two. So the point is reference radiation is very important, and when you're trying to look at an entire data set and come up with a recommended value, you have to take into consideration that people may have used different reference radiations in their studies. Okay. One of the other issues we have to deal with is that many of these RBE values have been derived for very large doses and high dose rates. It's simply you want to get enough of an effect that you can readily measure it. But what we're interested in the arena of environmental protection is typically relatively low doses from a radiobiological perspective and relatively low dose rates. Okay. We also have the challenge for humans. Our focus has been largely on the issue of stochastic effects. We want to limit to the extent practicable, the occurrence of cancers, for example. With regard to environmental protection, the focus is more towards deterministic effects. We want to ensure that the populations are stable and not adversely impacted, but we're not particularly as concerned, if you will, for cancer causation in organisms in the wild. So, again, we have to come up with RBEs for these two conditions, and I'll refer in a minute to terms called RBEM and RBEM, which I take a little bit of issue to the ICRP in coming up with this nomenclature, because depending on the type of font you use, the M's may not be distinguishable from each other. But when we're looking at biological endpoints, we consider stochastic effects such as chromosomal aberrations, induction of DNA double strand breaks, mutation and chromosome breaks, and then for deterministic, our focus is things such as survival, acute injury, cell death, tissue impairment. We know, of course, that RBE depends on a number of things: the LET, the linear energy transfer of the radiation under consideration, the dose and the dose rate, how that dose is delivered, is it uniform, is it external to the organism, is it internally deposited, is it injected, are we looking at cells, are we looking at tissues, what's the endpoint, can the cells repair, what are their capabilities? All of these things have an influence on what that RBE value becomes. let's take just for a minute linear energy transfer, which, you know, conceptually you think about irradiation moving through matter, setting in motion charged particles. We typically will talk about KeV per micron. We know alpha particles naturally that occur through radioactive decay of the naturally occurring ones. Their energy ranges 4 to maybe 8 MeV, and if you look at their linear energy transfer, on the order of 100 KeV per micron, although that LET changes as the particle slows down and is losing its energy. The lower LET radiations, X-rays and gamma rays, have substantially lower LET on the order of 3.5 KeV per micron or less. Now, I want you to think a little bit about, you know, what is our principal target of concern. Now, there is some debate in the radiobiological community if DNA is truly the only big issue in terms of radiation effects. But for purposes of this discussion, you know, you think about DNA. Well, DNA is not just this double helix. It appears in a variety of forms within the cell, and depending on how it's packaged, it may make a more attractive target, if you will, for damage at certain stages in the cell cycle. So this is an example blatantly stolen from Helmholtz's website, showing the simulation of an alpha particle track, a 10 MeV alpha particle, across severely bundled DNA and the nature of the damage that can be caused by that alpha particle as it moves through the cellular system. So the point being is that there are all these complicating factors. It's an easy enough charge to say, go out and find the RBEs for a variety of studies, come up with a nominal factor. But what you find is that if you look at sort of classic, here's a classic cell survival, this is not so important to know exactly what the dose ranges are, but this would be dose, this is going to be fraction surviving, and this is for a wide range of radiation types that have been used in the study, from very low LET radiation to high energy neutrons, alpha particles. And if you want to calculate the RBE of each of these relative to the reference radiation, the question becomes, well, where do I do the calculation? How do I do it? You can look at 80% survival, which is right here. You could look at 10% survival. You could look at 1% survival. And if you calculate an RBE at any of those and you express it in this particular graph taken from Berenson in 1968, what you see is that your RBE changes as a function of LET, certainly, but also at the point where you're doing your calculation. So this is kind of a confounding factor and when you're trying to pull this data together. So what people have done, again, this is just a little bit of illustration where you're comparing two radiation types. You have high LET radiation, typically a linear response, low LET radiation, a linear quadratic kind of a response. You can calculate an RBE at a high level of effect. You come up with a value. You can calculate an RBE at a low level of effect, and typically you come up with a higher value. A little bit of a consternation there. And this is just an example for alpha particles versus your reference radiation of X-rays under a couple of different systems. And again, different values of RBE. You can have equations that fit the line for high LET, low LET. And the point being is if you look at this data set, you look at a range of doses over which you're doing your observation, what you find is that that RBE comes to a sort of a maximal value. So it varies as a function of dose, but below about a tenth of a gray, what you see is that that dose or that RBE actually levels off. And so this gives us a point where we can have sort of a stable value of RBE to do our calculations. And this is where the terminology comes in, RBEM, either for deterministic or stochastic, for a maximal value. And that's what we're interested in. There are techniques where you can calculate it. The ICRP, in a couple of its publications, has gone through the mathematics and given you an approach. Alternatively, you can measure it. And what people have seen, again, it depends on the type of radiation that you're concerned with, if there is a pronounced dose effect in terms of what you see for the RBE. So again, the charge to this committee was we were to look at the literature on RBE, looking at both deterministic and stochastic effects. And when we were looking for deterministic, things such as normal tissue effects, we looked at early and late, and cell killing is the major issue. But again, our purpose was to look at both deterministic and stochastic. We looked primarily at alpha particles, although we went into the realm of somewhat more exotic particles if their LET was similar to the alphas. They can be used as surrogates, for example. So we looked at alphas, fission neutrons, and also tritium. And then the charge to the committee was to recommend dose-modifying values that are relevant for non-human biota in the context of environmental protection. We spent a considerable amount of time. Hundreds of papers actually were pulled into consideration. But what we found is that a lot of them had to be rejected. In large part, the issues of dosimetry, how do you actually calculate the dose that's delivered, is not necessarily a simple question. You have the issue of an internally deposited radionuclide where your reference radiation is externally applied. And it might not have been possible from the data set to calculate this RBE maximal value. And so ultimately, while we went through hundreds of papers, we came down to a subset, which is around 100. And we would have liked to have seen more to give us a little bit more confidence in what we're doing. So I'm just giving you sort of a brief overview. These are some summary of the alpha particle or alpha papers on non-human biota, where we looked at both deterministic and stochastic. And this is just giving you an indication of the kinds of endpoints: cell survival, DNA damage, chromosomal aberration. We had in vivo, ex vivo studies, in vitro studies. But if you look at the number of papers total that we had to consider for alpha particles on alpha, it was really, really, really very small. If you look at the range of RBEs that have been calculated, what we find is that majority of them were less than about 10 for the RBE, again, focusing both on deterministic and stochastic. There are a handful of papers that are out there that have substantially greater RBE calculations. For a few alpha emitters, there are papers with RBEs on the order of 100, 200, 270, I think, is one of the highest values that was calculated for it. But again, what you see is range generally below 10. And again, this is showing you the range of LET, KeV per micron and such that was considered, and the RBEs that were observed. We also looked, I should say, Almedina spent a tremendous amount of time looking at data on tritium. And the issue with tritium is that you can have it as HTO, you can have it as a tritiated gas, or you can have it as organically bound tritium. And what we found in the survey of the literature is by far the bulk of the studies were on HTO, tritiated water. And in essence, there are really only a couple on organically bound tritium, so we were not really, with any degree of confidence, able to recommend RBE, or a radiation weighting factor, if you will, for tritium. The range that we saw, generally less than 3, majority towards 2 and lower for tritium, but it's a small number. So I just want to note that in this analysis of the RBE data, what we saw was, you know, there's a large number of factors that contribute to the RBE, the endpoint, the cell line, whether it's in vivo, in vitro. You have to deal with the issue of the experimental models. Are you using live animals? Are you using cell cultures, you know, in vivo, in vitro? Are the cell lines that are being considered modified? Are they cancer prone? Have genes been added or removed to enhance radio resistance or radio sensitivity? How does that affect the calculation in the process? Okay. Variations and inconsistencies within experimental setups was a huge deal. The choice of the reference radiation also confounds it. High dose rates, high doses, extrapolating down to the low dose region that we're really concerned in. And then ultimately, trying to take this information from cell data to, in a large part, and extrapolate that to an individual and then on to population impacts. So these are all issues that sort of complicate the process. So we have just submitted our draft on the critical evaluation of the RBE data. We have made recommendations for nominal dose modifying factors. 10 for alpha emitters is what it appears. Tritium is still under discussion, but the committee, this task group, is looking at nominal values, really more towards 2, but we have insufficient data for organically bound tritium to recommend a value at this particular point. And as I mentioned, the data are really limited by endpoint and species, and therefore we have to have some judgment in extrapolating to a whole organism. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Kathy. And we did allow the speakers to run a little bit over. I think it would have been impossible to stop them anyway, but that still gives us a little bit of time now for questions and comments. So please. Yeah, there is a microphone coming.
Thank you. Volker Dreisma, the Netherlands. I'm working in a facility that's placed in the dunes. So our reverence animals are the gull and the rabbit, mainly. But I agreed with one of the statements of the speaker that most of us probably think that the impact of radiation from normally regulated sources on the environment is quite limited. So my question is actually, why do we put all this, say, detailed effort in protecting animals and plants from radiation, as we know that in regulated situations it's probably harmless to the environment, at least compared with other risks they suffer. The rabbits on our territory are affected by outbreaks of viral infestations like myxomatosis. The number of common gulls, herring gulls, and lesser blackback gulls at our institute decreased dramatically because the fox is now roaming around, and I would suggest to have some common, only 2 or 3 or 5 pathways to specific situations, for instance, emergency or accumulations of americium in shellfish, and that be more in a, say, global way. Hey, these are 2 or 3 things we should address when protecting the environment, and spend other efforts in those calculations to protect the environment in another way.
Anyone want to respond to that or comment on that? David?
Just have a mini argument, as we usually do. So. I think that, I say, for most situations, most facilities and so on, that is probably true. There are situations, for example, with maybe uranium mines or certain parts of the industry where there may not be the case in all situations. So I think there is a need for a clear and transparent framework and assessment approach to actually be able to do this. I think if you're talking about spending lots of money and so on, then I think you can do certain types of assessments in a very simple manner. And one of the things that we haven't talked about here in any way is that many of the assessment approaches that are being developed use things like tiered approaches. So you can do simple, very quick, not quite back of the envelope calculations, but very quick calculations. And then you can use more sophisticated approaches, if you like, for those infrequent situations where you might need to go into more detail. So I think there is a clear need, in my view anyway, that the legislation drives you to being able to demonstrate that the environment is protected. And I think Jan made that point very clearly as well, that we have to be able to demonstrate that we're protected, but we can do so in different ways in terms of the complexity, if you like, of the answer. So.
Okay. Okay, we have it. Yep.
I'm Bjorn Cederwall. I'm from Stockholm. I represent myself. I should say I work with the nuclear power industry, but I have also worked 8 years with environmental protection, Angus biotaxonomy, and protection of threatened species. My issue is a little philosophical about this. Reference man was not developed to radio protect human diversity. And so here we're entering another endpoint when we talk about biological diversity, and it should also be understood that the biological unit, the defined one, is a species. The concept family, for instance, is a human stipulated type of definition, but the only biological definition is the species. The reference, the RAP, does not have any genetic properties, and therefore you cannot predict anything about population biology in terms of genetic dynamics. And I notice here, and I heard several other talks earlier today, that there is no focus or mentioning really on what goes down in the germline. And that is probably the most complex area here. But the good news is that much of this has already been understood, because there is a publication that sheds a lot of light on this from 1968 that anyone can download from PNAS, EALA, who irradiated Drosophila 3 times in a row, populations, each time 6 degrees, and you can see for yourself, and you will understand what types of challenges we have. And if you have a biology background, just one piece of literature that will throw a lot of light on this for the understanding of philosophy, I say Ernst Mayr, 1971. There you have the impacts of mutations, selection pressures, and all this is explained. You can save a lot of money, I think, from instead of doing perhaps a lot of measurements and calculations. Just think and consider the philosophical issues, and I think there are shortcuts here. Thank you.
Anyone wants to comment on that? They are just making their mind up. We wait a little bit. All right, Jan.
Sorry, I'm deaf. I have to have things passed on to me. Your comments, as I understand it, is why did we use those particular family groups and so on? It's really been pragmatic. We spent a long time talking to biologists and ecologists, and you can imagine you get as many opinions as there are ecologists and biologists. And you could either say, okay, well, we said we don't do anything, or you've got to start somewhere. It's not until you start doing something and putting it down that you can then see what people's comments are. And there are certainly many approaches that one could use. The approach that we used, I think, was driven as much as anything to be something that was very similar to the approach that we've used in relation to human beings, and therefore would be recognisable to those in the broader community of radiological protection. And in doing so, take your mind back to the sort of history of radiation protection of human beings. It was based on a 30-year-old Caucasian human being and so on. And that was a basic data set. You have to have some numbers, and then you can see how things differ from that. We thought the best approach was to try and start with what we know, where the data are. And most of the data relate to the types of animals and plants we're talking about. A, you can keep them in laboratories, B, you can do experiments over a reasonable period of time. You've got a pine tree that lives for 200 years. It's a bit more awkward, but some stages are more radio sensitive than others. And if you look at the literature around the globe, then it's not done at individual species. People have used local species and so on. But at family level, in a biological sense, there are enough internal similarities of biology to start zoning on that. There have been other arguments, well, why not just say it's a large mammal, it's a small mammal, and so on. You can then reach the stage where your definition is so broad and wide that it's almost meaningless. And it doesn't really help when you want to zero in on particular aspects of dosimetry and effect and so on. The other thing is putting it into proportion, as people have said, you know, is this a big issue? Well, by and large, I would say no. But then every industry will say that. The chemical industry says that. The petroleum industry says that. All industries say this is a big issue. 99% of the time, we behave perfectly well.
the amount that's being released in the environment is extremely small. Okay, every now and then something goes wrong. But you need to be in a position where you can then deal with it on the basis of good science. And we've seen no reason why the nuclear industry should be the exception, which by and large it has been the exception. And if you want to gain public confidence and acceptance and so on, you have to do what the other industries have done. So there is no perfect way. There's no shortcut. I mean, what we've tried to do is to develop a reasonably good scientific base, primarily in relation to those who understand radiation effects rather than the ecology side. One of the slides, two of the slides that David flicked through very quickly, which were actually probably two of the more interesting ones, is that when people are actually dealing with protection of the ecosystem, how do you protect the ecosystem? How do you know what it is? Even to measure it, you have to interfere it and fiddle with it. By and large, if you look at the EC directives, what you do is take a subset. You have a complex ecosystem, but it usually has one or two dominant populations. And so if you look at the impacts on those populations and how sensitive that is to whatever the impact is, then that is most likely to disturb it. But to do that, you still have points of reference. And because radiation affects individuals, if it affects enough individuals, it affects a population. If you've got that sort of information, it's a place to start. Again, radiation protection of human beings has evolved over 70 or 80 years, and it's still not all that wonderful. In 7 years, we've tried to come up with something for the protection of everything else. You've got to have numbers, you've got to have plans, you've got to have something. When it's there, you can then look at the good bits, the bad bits, the bits that are missing, the bits where, you know, we calculate dose. Well, if you can't calculate the dose with an order of magnitude, you know, you're already having trouble. So let's get some of the key bits of science right and then get these other things fixed. That's
all right.
If you've got to speak to me again, you have to come up here because I'm deaf.
I think that we take only one more question now, and we are sort of reaching an end to this. So Mikhail, please. No. We are taking one more question, please. Mikhail.
I have a question to Professor Kiely.
My
name is Michael Woshpe. I'm working in Norwegian Radiation Protection Authority, mainly with mathematical modeling, especially for marine environment. And I'm interested in some special effects which specific for low doses. It's an interesting effect, non-target, et cetera, et cetera. I'm interested in, you mentioned it was many works about estimation of RBE. Not all work, unfortunately, is very good for using, especially for maybe for modeling. But I have one question. Is it some differences between estimation of RBE in vitro and in vivo? Is it possible to say something about that?
Yes, but I don't remember.
It's good.
No, I don't remember either. The document as it currently stands is about 180 plus pages. But we do have tables where we try to separate the experiments with some text.
Is it the
but in vitro? Sorry.
I mean, I've got some tabulated data.
Yeah, it is to the extent we were able to tabulate by in vitro and in vivo, we've done that. And there's tables in the draft report, assuming they survived the commission review, and some associated text. So it's too much for me to ask at this time of the day. But can I ask a question since I have the microphone? Very.
That's not exactly fair, you can.
No, it's totally unfair. A very quick one, though. It's sort of two questions at once. One of which, in a laboratory, you can control what you're exposing a test species to. In the environment, you're almost never just exposed to radiation. It's radiation and heat, or radioactivity and salinity and something else. So I have a question. Maybe Jan or David could comment on where we stand in multiple exposures, because that's what the real world is. And the other question, 20 years ago or so, when we were doing pulp and paper effluent, we looked at variability. And there's a big natural variability, whether it's in, say, benthic species diversity or in population levels. Can you comment on how radiation is distinguished from natural variability in background population levels? Thank you.
I'll answer the first question if I can. Do we take into account other stressors? The answer is no. We don't for human beings. In relation to human beings, we simply look at radiation risk, in fact, in isolation. Of course, you know that there are lots of other risks out there from substances and so on, but we don't take that into account. And we don't here either. In terms of having a dialogue with the people who are concerned about environmental protection in general, of course, they realise it's just one stressor amongst many, but we don't. And I think that's sensible. You stick to something we know about. That's the answer to the first question. What was the second question?
I'd have preferred the first bit as well. Just to clarify, you're talking about whether we actually consider natural background within assessments and so on. Is that what you meant?
The variability of natural background.
Yeah, okay. I don't remember on your figure. On the DCRL band figure, I think certainly in my presentation, there was actually a line at the bottom which actually highlighted the natural background range. And one of the other things you can compare to, other than the DCRL bands, is actually the variation in the natural background. There are a number of studies, both in the aquatic and terrestrial environment, which have looked at calculating natural background to the RAPs specifically. We have that information and it is being incorporated into the assessments. It's not specifically considered, I think, other than saying at the moment in the framework that you can consider natural background. You want to add to that?
I think the bottom band in our tabulated information is an order of magnitude, and by and large, background dose rates are within that. The things that would make a substantial difference to background dose rates are probably going to be alphas, and that's where we need the RBE value. If you look at different types of particularly marine fauna, the different levels of particularly polonium-210, vary by orders of magnitude from one organ to another. And also, of course, you've got radon in relation to the terrestrial environment. What holds us up there is the better dosimetry and the RBE information. Once we've got that, I think one of the rather interesting outcomes of this exercise will be a much better characterization of the natural background radiation dose and its range for different types of animals and plants and different types of environment. Just as a piece of science, that's interesting. It's even more interesting if you run it back in geological time and see how this has varied over time and the role indeed it may have played in other aspects of biology. I mean, that's a side point, if you like, but it nevertheless demonstrates that in the recent past, all sorts of statements have been made about, oh yes, don't worry about radiation environment, we protect the environment and do all this sort of stuff. Statements are easily made. When you start unpicking the science behind it, we don't even know what the background radiation to different types of animals and plants is, let alone the impact of increased levels. So unraveling that science, I think, helps us generally appreciate what the issue is, how big the issue is, and helps you then have a dialogue with those who may or may not be concerned about it. You've got to start off with the basics of good, sound scientific knowledge, then see where that leads you. In the past, that hasn't been done. And I think perhaps statements that have been made in the past have actually inhibited the development of that aspect of science.
All right, I think we draw this to a close now. There are still some hands up there, and I hope that you will be able to approach the presenters after this session and during coffee. So once again, thanks to all the presenters.